I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Electric cars. We haven't really spent a great deal of time talking about electric cars on this podcast. In this episode, we are going to, but I don't think we'll be discussing the Renault Zoe too heavily. We'll be taking more of a DN, more of an enthusiast's perspective on EVs. And then just to balance things out, because this is Drive Nation, we'll also talk about the new McLaren 765LT, which we've both been driving. Andrew, back to electric cars. Living the life that you do right now, could you live with just an EV, and would you want to?
First, hello everybody. Second, that is two very distinct questions. And I'm afraid I think the answer to both is, well, the answer one is definitely no, I couldn't. And would I want to? I think the answer to that is, at best, not yet. So, you know, I live, I mean, I don't live on the moon, but I live reasonably remotely in the Welsh borders. To me, the absolute minimum job any car I have has to be able to do is get to Heathrow and back without me having to stop, even for, you know, 10 minutes to fill it up with fuel, let alone however long you'd have to stop it for to get enough electricity in it to get it back. And you can't do that. I suppose in ideal conditions, you know, if you got a Tesla with its biggest battery and you drove like a church mouse down the motorway and everything else, then possibly you could. But that's no good to me. You know, I want to know that when I get into a car late for an aeroplane, remember those, at 4 o'clock on a cold winter's morning, and I've got the heater on, and I've got the bum warmers on, and the wipers are going, and the air conditionings are on, and I want to know that I can peg it all the way to Heathrow and all the way back again, and not even have to think about whether it's going to run out of juice. And, you know, even if it were a Taycan or anything else, it's, you know, that journey is about 260 miles. And there is no electric car which in any conditions will do that, particularly if we're going down motorways. So the answer to the first question is no, I couldn't. And secondly, would I want to? No, I wouldn't, because, you know, even the very best of them, and I bow to no one in my admiration for the Porsche Taycan, which, you know, I'm sure we would agree is the best electric car on sale. It's as I say, it's a car I really, really admire. I mean, it is technologically incredible. It's quite Porsche-like in the way that it responds, but there's still not enough of what I want in a car in terms of, you know, how it sounds and how it responds, for it to be, you know, a replacement for a daily driver with a nice, you know, internal combustion engine in it. And the other point I guess I would also make is, you know, however hard the manufacturers try to make, you know, good and great electric cars, I mean, the charging infrastructure in this country, at least, is so shonky. You know, I had a diesel hybrid E-Class for a bit quite recently, And so that's a car that, you know, you don't have to charge, but just because it's interesting, I went and plugged it into a few of these ecotricity stations, and so many of them, you know, don't work, or you have to sign up to things, or they're already taken, and there's some bloke sitting in the the service station having his breakfast while his car's already fully charged, and it's just, you know, you can't guarantee that even if you're prepared to wait however long it is to get however much electricity you need in the car, that you're going to be able to do it. You know, and you and I will both know people who have been taking electric cars to shoots who have turned up hours late because they spent the time crawling around the countryside, you know, at 20 miles an hour, desperately trying to find somewhere they can plug this thing in because the place they thought they were going to plug in didn't turn out to be working. And, you know, clearly that is all going to change. And these, you know, 350 kilowatt ion chargers, and if you've got a Tesla, you've obviously got the supercharger network, which works quite well, I understand. You know, life will get better. But right here, right now, long answer to short question, no.
And no and no. There we go. Pretty conclusive. Yeah, I mean, you're right. The charging infrastructure will improve. But for the time being, EVs, they sort of play a very specific role, don't they? And that they can do. But the moment you sort of challenge them a bit more with, you know, those one of those occasional journeys that we all have to do, that they're not quite cut out for, all of a sudden their usability is completely limited. Lots of them are great. You've mentioned the Porsche Taycan, which is a very good car. The Teslas, they're, you know, extraordinary in their way. But the issue for me is that I think it's a long, long time before I could have only an electric car and no access to anything else. You know, there are plenty that I would like to have as part of a small collection. You know, I could imagine having a Honda E, for instance. I've spoken about it before, and it's a good car. I don't think it's brilliant. But it'd be great to have one of those just for knocking around town. But that's all it would be, and I would have to have another combustion car, which sort of totally defeats the point. So I think that point where, you know, one electric car covers all my needs is a long way off. And that's even before we start talking about, you know, the more emotional side of driving, which is just a totally different challenge for those vehicles altogether, isn't it?
It is. And another thing that worries me slightly about these cars is, one of my favourite electric cars is the BMW i3. Now, that came out, I think, in 2013. And I'm not sure in the 7 years. Now, you know, this is a new technology, isn't it? So you would think we would just be light years ahead of where the i3 was in 2013. But I'm not sure that we are. If I think about, you know, the electric cars, which put even a sort of, you know, faint crease on my face, let alone a massive great grin, the i3 would be up there. And, you know, a BMW, they took the decision to do it properly, and they tried to make it light and succeeded. And they used some very expensive materials like carbon fiber in its production. And, you know, if you go and drive, you know, an i3 today, it's very old technology. But actually, it's, you know, how far has the world moved from there? There are lots of different sorts of electric cars have come out. But are they actually, you know, in terms of, for instance, their range or the way they provide their power, are they actually doing the job dramatically differently to that? And therefore, is it really going to change that much more over the next 7 years? Or are we still waiting for, you know, that mythical big breakthrough, which so many people have spoken about? I mean, and frankly, it's what the Dyson car was going to do until, you know, he canned it. That was going to be a solid state car because in theory, solid state is the answer to almost everything electric. In practice, it is apparently extremely difficult to productionize. So difficult, in fact, that one of Britain's richest, most, you know, inventive, creative people couldn't find a way to do it, despite the, you know, the enormous amount of money he dropped into it. So, yeah, I'm not quite sure where it's going, to be honest.
Well, do you know what? You're absolutely right, because I think all electric cars right now, it's a slightly almost ironic thing to say, because they seem so innovative because they don't have combustion engines. But in fact, there's no innovation there, no technological innovation, because lithium-ion battery packs are just what they are. You know, their energy density and so on. It's just what it is. And there's nothing that can be done about that until, as you say, that next quantum leap in technology arrives, if that ever happens. And that probably is solid-state batteries. But until then, actually, all anybody can do is harness the technology that's available to them right now. They can't innovate. They can't pioneer, not in drastic ways. At best, you can do what Tesla do and have very good control systems, but the batteries are just what they are at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, they are better than they have been. I can remember talking to the McLaren guys when I spent a bit of time in the Speedtail and talking about how the batteries for that work relative to the batteries in the P1 back in whenever that was, 2000. I think that was also about 2013, wasn't it? And clearly the game has moved on a bit, but what they're doing is, you know, is finding more efficient, exactly what you say, they're finding more efficient ways to use what they've already got, when actually what they need is something else.
Exactly. And so, yeah, so when I look at cars like the Lotus Evija, well, for one thing, I think it looks stunning, but I also don't see the innovative, pioneering engineering in that car. I just see, stuff that has existed for several years now being wrapped up into one vehicle. And that's kind of my issue with them at the moment. So I was at Hampton Court Concours a couple of weeks ago, and the Lotus was there with the Evija. And I went over, had a look at it, and it looks fantastic. I don't know if you've seen one.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's a fantastic looking car. Absolutely love it. Yeah.
Really striking. And Gav Kershaw was there, and he's the driving wizard who makes all Lotuses handle beautifully. And he's tasked with doing the same to this car. And I said to him, so how do you apply those old Lotus principles to a heavier car? And it was interesting. He heard me say, to a heavy car. And he quite sharply said, well, it's not that heavy, is it? And I said, no. I said, to a heavier car, because actually it is twice as heavy as other Lotus models, or thereabouts, you know. So there seems to be a certain degree of sensitivity about that car. And it's going to be very, very interesting to see how it plays out. But I spoke to him for a little while, and it's really interesting hearing him talk about it, because actually he is quite right. It's not, the Evija is not that much heavier than a 911 Turbo S. I think it's 40 kilograms or something. So relatively, you know, it's just under 1,700. So it's not a light car, but
just under 1,700 kilos. That sounds awfully light to me, but maybe.
Well, what they've done is, you know, there's lots of carbon fiber and, you know, all sorts of exotic lightweight materials, but the reason it's light is that it has a 70 kilowatt hour battery, and that is, you know, compared to the Rimac Concept 2 and the Pininfarina, its sister car, they've got 100 plus kilowatt hour batteries. And so that's how you make an EV light. You make its battery slightly too small.
So you compromise the car.
Yeah, exactly. And it's all they can do. It's all they can do, because the batteries are what they are.
And the thing is, going back to a point you made about, you know, technology, what you're actually finding is the technology gains and where the technology is actually being deployed. Not so much in the EV drivetrain, but everything else to try and mitigate the problems that the EV drivetrain brings, i.e. its weight. And, you know, this is something that BMW knew back with the i3, you know, 7 years ago. And the really clever stuff in the i3 is not its battery pack or its electric motors. It's the way that they constructed the rest of the car to try to keep its weight within manageable levels. And I'm sure with the Evija, that's the same deal. That all the really trick stuff has gone into, as I say, you know, just trying to make sure that, you know, you've made the best possible fist that you can of, you know, the problem that comes with building, you know, any electric car, which is simply its mass.
And Gav Kershaw was saying that, you know, an amount of that weight can be disguised with its very clever all-wheel torque vectoring, because it's got one motor per wheel, so you can do super trick things with directing torque to precisely which corner you want it with much more precision than you can with a combustion engine, and make it do quite funky things, and it apparently feels incredible, particularly coming out of, away from an apex, coming out of corners. Just the precision and the crispness with which it does that, says Kershaw, is remarkable. I've felt something similar in the Rimac, and I can vouch for it. It does feel incredible.
Yeah, and I felt something similar. Okay, this is a hybrid, but the bit I'm talking about is the electric in the Ferrari SF90 with its electrically driven front axle. Its ability to control how the car is behaving through the micromanaging of torque, which you can do with electricity, which in a way that you cannot do with an internal combustion engine, is absolutely amazing, which means you can drift it, you know, with your eyes shut. But you know, you can do that, and you can say, haha, we're disguising the car's weight. What you cannot disguise is the feel. And you know, the SF90, which is another car that I really admire and liked in many ways. You know, it's a heavy car, and you can feel it in the steering, you can feel it in the brakes, you can just feel it. I don't think you can engineer your way out of that.
That is the problem, isn't it? That is the problem. So they say the Avaya will shatter Hethel lap records. I'm sure it will. It's encouraging that they're making it steer and ride and handle properly before they switch the torque vectoring on. So, you know, it's not there simply to paper over cracks. They want it to be fundamentally a good car before they start fiddling with that stuff. But, you know, I want to know what you think of the principle of a 2,000 horsepower road car.
Well, we've been here, I mean, I've spoken and written at length about this in the past. I don't understand it. You know, I wish Lotus all the luck in the world, and I hope that under its new management with proper investment, it does brilliantly well. But I think the Avaya is a statement, isn't it? It's a symbol. It's a, hey, look at us, we're back. You know, I don't know. I suppose you can never prejudge these things before you drive them. But I've driven electric cars with, you know, 700 horsepower. And they made me feel sick. It's true, you know, for two reasons. A, they are so massively accelerative, but also the way they deliver their torque, i.e. all of it instantly, it's just not very comfortable. You know, an internal combustion engine, it's quite, you know, you don't necessarily feel it at the time, but there is some progression and your body does have some time to adapt and prepare itself for what's coming. Whereas an electric car, it just feels like violent. And that's with a car with, let's say, you know, maybe one third of the power that the Avaya is going to have. Now, you know, there will be other issues too. You cannot, even with, you know, four-wheel drive, you can't transmit 2,000 horsepower to the road, because you're talking about, you know, if you do that, 500 horsepower per tyre with the accompanying torque that goes with it. So, you know, goodness knows what speed you're going to be actually travelling at before you can feel what that 2,000 horsepower feels like. And you know, to me, the problem with these cars are, you know, the engineers have looked at electric cars and they know that the emotional side of things just isn't there, because you can't change gear because it doesn't have a gearbox. It doesn't, you know, there's no sound worthy of the mention, let alone the listening to. So all you can do is make them fast. And it's almost like they thought, well, we can do this, therefore that's what we're going to do. And we're just going to give it just preposterous amounts of power. And, you know, I guess once it will be interesting to see what that actually feels like. But don't tell me that is in any way a substitute for a car that is light and agile and lithe and sounds wonderful and you can change gear and really involves you in the driving experience. I just, you know, maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe I'll get in it and I'll have this sort of road to Damascus experience and I'll just go, oh, right, okay, now I get it. Now I understand what these guys are on about. But, you know, I am very much a skeptic when it comes to electric sports cars. And I'll tell you why. You know, and I make a point of doing this. In fact, I had exactly this conversation with Mike Fluitt at McLaren when I drove the 765 last week, and I sat down with him and we had a wide-ranging discussion about all sorts of things, and you know, he absolutely acknowledges that sooner or later McLaren will have to do an EV. And I said, well, how do you do an electric sports car? And like everybody else I've asked that question to, he doesn't have an answer.
He doesn't say
there isn't an answer, and there isn't one out there, and there isn't a way of doing it. And you know, they've actually got at least one, maybe two electric mules running at the moment. But, you know, as far as, you know, right now, right here, with the technology that exists today, how do you make an emotional connection between the driver and his or her electric car? There is no answer to that question at the moment. And until, you know, and I've asked Porsche this question, I've asked Ferrari this question, I've asked, you know, the absolute best in the business. And if they don't have the answer to the question, it is because I suspect the answer, certainly today, is not out there.
I asked the very same question of the boss of Audi Sport, whose name evades me at the moment. But I said to him, is there anything you can say that will make me feel in any way sort of more confident that an electric sports car can be truly engaging to drive the way perhaps an R8 is? And he went quiet for a while as he peered off into the distance. And then someone else from the press corps just said, no, then. And he, you know, he ultimately said something, but I can't remember what the answer was. And
so you weren't entirely convinced by it, clearly.
No, not at all. I mean, we were talking about, it's the e-tron GT, isn't it? They're effectively their Taycan, which is coming soon. And he, you know, he said something about the response you get, the precision you get from electric motors, that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's a unsatisfactory answer, really. And I sort of feel for them, because all of these guys and girls, I mean, because what do you do with an electric powertrain to make it genuinely exciting and thrilling the way that a really good combustion engine could be? I don't know, but at some point someone's going to have to come along and demonstrate that it can be done.
Would it not be better just to accept that, you know, right here, right now, you can't do it? And so car manufacturers concentrate on creating EVs, which you may not be able to do right now, but which you know are not far away, i.e. EVs, which do have, you know, decent range and reasonable charge times and can be used as transport, which frankly is the reason that the vast majority of cars get sold around the world. And then you keep your sports cars, you keep the internal combustion engines for your sports cars, or you find another way of doing it, you know, maybe by putting hydrogen through your internal combustion engine or whatever. You know, find a way of synthetic fuels, exactly. Try to find a way of, you know, of keeping what we've got, but addressing their fundamental problem, which is the fact that they consume fossil fuels. And yeah, and maybe that's the way forward. You mean, there are just some things that can't be done. And I'm not saying that you can't make an electric car that's truly sporting, but I am saying I can't see how right now that you can. So, you know, difficult, yeah, isn't it?
It really is. So you've mentioned the Taycan, and it's a properly impressive machine, isn't it? I mean, if the range and the charging works for you, then God, it's just, it would be a wonderful thing to use daily. It drives really well. It's so refined. It's got the cabin quality is exceptional. And there is talk of the next generation Cayman and Boxster having fully electric variants, which will be really interesting. And that's got to be the big test of the next gen, or the first generation, yeah, really, of electric sports cars, isn't it? Porsche getting into it, because they really understand the touchy feely aspect of driving that we're all into.
Yeah. I think the operative word in what you just said is variant.
They
won't be the only ones. And so that will allow Porsche, obviously, to sell Boxsters and Caymans to people who just like the idea of driving a Boxster or a Cayman, but aren't necessarily that interested in the actual driving experience itself. Maybe they buy them for, you know, for the image or whatever. And then they will also continue to be able to sell Boxsters and Caymans with internal combustion engines or hybrids to people who really want to drive them. And so they'll be able to keep both camps happy while at the same time having a real world way of testing the market. And so I think that's, you know, as long as it's, you know, it doesn't cost them huge amounts in terms of developing completely separate powertrains for these cars, I think that's probably quite a sensible way forward.
Yeah, why wouldn't you, I suppose? Okay, so that's electric sports cars, but what about an electric Rolls-Royce or an electric Bentley saloon?
Love it. Absolutely love it, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, what do you want a car like that to be? You want it to be quiet and comfortable, you know? So, you know, big, heavy, luxury. I mean, I drove Rolls-Royce, like, it's got some code name, which I've long since forgotten, but a few years ago, Rolls-Royce did an electric Phantom based on the previous generation car, which I spent a few hours wandering around West Sussex in, and there was nothing about it I didn't think was appropriate to a Rolls-Royce. It was utterly silent. It was supremely comfortable, and it just delivered massive amounts of torque. It was completely effortless. I just think that, you know, for that kind of car, absolutely, I think electric cars are completely wonderful. And even if, you know, you can't get massive batteries into them, although the weight of those cars matters so much less, so you probably can. You know, hopefully, you know, the key to range anxiety isn't range itself, but it's fast recharging.
It's charging,
So, you know, I had a Taycan quite recently, and I actually drove it. Some may remember the podcast I did with Gordon Murray, and I drove it from home down to Gordon Murray's place at Dunsfold. Quite clearly wasn't going to get back, so I rather cheekily popped into Porsche at Reading, where they have 350 kilowatt chargers. And plugged in the Taycan, and I just watched electricity just cascade into this car. And you know, and when those things are as prevalent as petrol pumps, and when crucially the cars that we buy are able to charge at that rate, because the Taycan at the moment is the only one that can, then we'll be in a completely different position, because then it won't particularly matter if you can only do 250 miles on a charge, because you know, in 7 or 8 minutes, you know, you're going to be on your way again, which frankly isn't an awful lot longer than you would be if you're filling it up with petrol. So that's the key to it. But, you know, we are some distance off there.
Yeah, we really are. Yeah, we are. The technology has to evolve, also the whole infrastructure around it. But I suppose, presumably, it will get there eventually, won't it?
Well, it will, but it's also, you know, so just
go
allow
on.
Me to just, well... I mean, I have some other concerns. There are the, you know, the environmental concerns, and I am not an expert. I don't need enough, and some people may rightly go, you've got completely the wrong end of the stick here. You know, like for like, it's still much cleaner than petrol. But, you know, there not enough is known, certainly in the public domain, about, you know, the cost of building cars from so much raw materials, you know, the cost of the rare earth metals that go into them, the whole recycling of them. You know, there are quite clearly, you know, human rights issues in terms of, you know, where you're digging these metals out of, in which countries. You know, cobalt coming out of mines in DRC, and, you know, there have been lots of reports of the amount of child labour that's been used. And so there are all these, you know, there are all these, you know, these other issues. And then also there's the cost of the electricity. Now, at the moment, depending, you know, if, as long as you charge at home and you're on an economy 7 tariff or whatever, it's not very expensive. If you go and use a fast or rapid charger at a service station, you will find it's, you know, it's cheaper than petrol, but not that much anymore. And this is before the government has figured out where it's going to get its tax back from. You know, all the tax that it currently rakes in from petrol revenue, well, you know, they're not going to say goodbye to that. So what are they going to do? And how do you tax someone for charging their car at home? How do you separate that charge from the charge for the electricity that they, you know, they have for their, you know, for their lights or their, you know, their heating or their cooking or whatever? And, you know, are we now looking at a sort of a road charging system where you just get charged for the electricity that you use? I don't know, but there are, you know, this is a massive issue, and I don't feel that the issues are being addressed, and I don't feel the public is really being honestly kept abreast of, you know, just how difficult this is all going to be to establish. And also, you know, I remain to be convinced that ultimately that electricity is the way forward for all these sorts of reasons.
Be aware of anybody who defiantly states that electric cars are the silver bullet for all the issues facing transportation. Sadly, there are other factors surrounding those vehicles, and the overall solution will look far more nuanced than just blanket EVs, I should think. There'll be synthetic fuels and hydrogen and other bits and pieces, depending on how certain vehicles are used.
Yeah, but ultimately, surely, if you want to create cars that are genuinely environmentally friendly, creating cars that weigh 2.5 tons of whatever that is can't be the way forward. You know, you have to make cars that use very little, both in terms of what they cost, what they take out of the ground to build, and then what they take out of the environment to run. And that, to me, just says light cars. And, you know, and car manufacturers, whatever they say, hate building light cars because it's so much easier to make a heavy car more powerful than it is to, you know, design a car to be lightweight. And so they will need some encouragement, either by carrot or stick. But ultimately, you know, you have these cars that weigh, you know, 2.5 tons. And I can't see that that is any kind of future at all. And I suspect that, you know, they always described hybrids as a bridging technology, didn't they? They, you know, the hybrids were the bridge from, you know, pure ICEs to EVs. And I think that EVs themselves are another bridge, because, you know, surely in the future, you know, hydrogen has to be the way forward. I certainly don't know any other technology which, you know, given that you can now obtain clean sources of hydrogen, and where the emissions, the tailpipe emissions, are only water, and I know that they come with all sorts of issues, but I think it has to be long-term a better solution than a pure EV. But what do I know?
I once spoke to a Lotus powertrain engineer, really interesting guy, and he said that hydrogen is the power of the future, and it always will be. It'll never be the fuel of today, because there are fundamental issues with it. But it's an interesting thing, you know. I've spoken to lots of people who think absolutely it will happen and it's got to happen, and others who, and engineers I mean, who think that fundamentally it doesn't work because of the energy it takes to gather the hydrogen and compress it into a way that it's usable. So it's another one that's going to have to play itself out.
But I mean, that has got a lot easier. I mean, you know, I'm no authority on this subject, but, you know, hydrogen fuel cell cars have been, you know, around for the 30 odd years that I've been doing this, in laboratories and prototype form and that sort of thing. And they've always been sort of, oh yeah, 10 to 15 years away. And the funny thing is that they have always been, and probably remain, you know, 10 to 15 years ago. But, you know, my understanding is that certainly one of the major issues always was a means of getting a clean source of hydrogen, because you could always steam it out of natural gas. You could actually steam it out of your domestic supply to your cooker. But, you know, you're still burning fossil fuel, so what's the gain there? And the problem always used to be that getting it cleanly through wind or solar or wave or whatever was always possible, but you could never do it at a price which the market would be prepared to pay. Now, obviously, huge leaps and strides have been made in that area over time. So I'm not saying we're there yet, but we're certainly an awful lot closer to it now than we ever have been before. And so my hope is that that's where we end up. But, you know, I don't know whether it's going to be 5, 10, 15, 20 years time from now.
I think there is a technology that exists that somehow creates hydrogen from methanol, perhaps, and it means that, so it creates it on the go. I actually don't understand how it works, but it means that you don't need to carry compressed hydrogen around, which is a huge advantage, because that's just, well, yeah, there are all sorts of issues there, particularly in fast-moving vehicles. That was all quite grown up, so can I just talk about hypercars again, please?
Yes, okay. Well, okay. No, you can't. Okay. Only because I just want to make one last point about hydrogen.
Years ago,
BMW had a fleet of 7 Series cars, 750 ILs, I think they were. And you got into one of these things and you drove, and it drove like a 750 IL. And then there was a big button in the middle of the dashboard, which you hit, and then suddenly it went from being powered by petrol to being powered by hydrogen. And yes, hydrogen is less energy dense than petrol. You know, there was a hit to the performance, but it still behaved like a normal internal combustion engine car. It still sounded like a V12, you know, and, you know, I at the time thought that was quite exciting. So, you know, I don't know whether they can do that in the future, but I just thought I would just mention that, because there is a way of putting clean sources of fuel through the engines that we love. And now onto the hypercars.
Okay, so I've mentioned Rimac already, and there was that interesting, fascinating news story a couple of weeks ago, wasn't there, that Rimac would, in a almost a roundabout way, be acquiring Bugatti, which is an extraordinary thing on the face of it, because Rimac is not yet a decade old, I don't think. And, you know, acquiring this historic old luxury motoring mark, it's an extraordinary thing. Actually, it looks like it's a bit of sort of shuffling and clever wrangling by the VW group, isn't it, to take a bigger stake in Rimac Automobilia. Fascinating.
But I think even that, you know, speaks volume for Rimac, you know, that, yeah. If, you know, Volkswagen, you know, the largest car company on earth, you know, is so interested in that technology, it's prepared to give up. I mean, I know that Bugatti, well, I understand that Bugatti's been for sale for a while. But I mean, I think it's a really clever move for both sides because, you know, your mate Rimac gets to sell cars with a, you know, one of the greatest badges on it, and that can only be good news for him. He also gets the association with the VW brand and the credibility that comes from it. And in the meantime, VW gets to, you know, access to all this fantastic technology that he's been developing. So I think it's a win-win. I really do.
Yeah, I do as well. And I think, given the way things have played out in that sort of very exclusive hypercar world, Bugatti, I think it kind of had to go electric eventually, didn't it? Which would presumably be an outcome of Rimac taking control of Bugatti. Because Bugatti's thing since the Veyron was always the most powerful cars out there, 1,000 horsepower, 1,500 horsepower when the Chiron came along. And then all of a sudden, these electric hypercars have come along with 2,000 and made the Bugattis look just a little bit daft.
Outgunned, yes.
Yeah, and, you know, how much power can you get from a combustion engine reliably? Probably not much more than 1,500, can you? So, it seems to me that from an engineering point of view, Bugatti's next play probably had to be go electric. But do people want to spend 2 million quid on electric cars? It's not been proven yet, is it?
Well, this is my mechanical watch theory. You know, people will spend thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands on the most exquisitely engineered mechanical watch to wear on their wrist. I don't know anybody who's ever spent more than 50 quid on an electric watch. No, that's not true. I have spent more than 50 quid on an electric watch, but
that didn't really stand up for long, did it, that comment?
No, but there's probably somebody listening to this who's going to be up in arms about this comment, but he knows how I feel. You know, electric watches are not inherently desirable collector's objects because people love that sense of engineering. They feel the love and the passion and the skill and the dedication that goes into creating these tiny, perfect little mechanized jewels. And you just don't get that by sticking in a battery in a, you know, and I fear that there is going to be a similar thing going with cars. I think people who really, really love those sorts of things, the aficionados, will always want to feel that they have got the highest quality precision engineering at their disposal and not just something with a bloody big battery.
Yeah. Yeah. If Pininfarina managed to sell all their Battistas without too much trouble, if Lotus managed to sell all their Avayas without any trouble, then clearly there's a demand for that sort of car. But if they have a hard time of it.
But even all those cars together, you're not talking about a lot of cars.
No, it's a couple of hundred, isn't it?
You know, if Porsche make an electric 911, which they ain't going to do anytime soon, believe me, and sales don't change, then you're looking at something significant. But, you know, 2,000 horsepower hypercars, you know, there will always be people who get those sorts of things for reasons that have got nothing whatever to do with, you know, how they handle. They just like the idea of having them. So, you know, it'll be interesting if those cars all sell out. And, you know, I wish them all, you know, the very best. But I don't think it's necessarily going to be indicative of what the rest of the world is going to do, for want of a better phrase, going forward.
All right. Well, that's where we stand on electric cars at the moment. I hope we weren't too dismissive, were we? I mean, it's clearly quite important that we find cleaner ways of getting around in our cars. I don't want to give the impression that we're blinkered and horribly old-fashioned.
I think electric cars could be really very exciting. Not exciting is the wrong word. Very what is the right word? Effective as transport. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, that's what most people buy their cars for. And you know, electric cars, they are quiet. You know, and you know, they do have emissions, but they're not generated at the car. They're generated at power stations and in the emissions of, you know, what it takes to build them and recycle them and everything else. But you know, so you will declog city centres, and they are quiet and they're comfortable. And I think there are all sorts of reasons why electric cars are really good news. And I think that, you know, the point here is, as you said right at the beginning, we're going to put a sort of DN take on these things. And you know, we're talking to a new audience of enthusiasts, so we have addressed this entire issue from the perspective of being enthusiasts. And I think as enthusiasts who love cars and love driving cars, I think they remain highly problematic.
Yes. Yeah, there you go. I think that's fair enough. Okay, well, let's forget about electric cars entirely, please. and
go on
and
then.
Talk about the McLaren 765LT. I mean, let's just do a 30 seconds on the 720S, the car that it's based on, because it's just such a brilliant, broadly capable car, isn't it? What do you reckon? I mean, does the idea of a more aggressive, faster one sort of light a fire within you?
I was very lucky to run a 720S for a bit, and to me, it's the best supercar on sale. Just because it's my old mantra about, you know, how much fun you have being determined by how enjoyable a car is multiplied by however many times you feel you want to drive it. And I just wanted to drive the 720S everywhere. I drove it in the snow, and it was such a broadly defined car. There was nothing which appeared to be an inappropriate use for that car. And that's why I just thought it was fabulous, and frankly such a hard act to follow. And what I would say before whatever it is else we say about the 765 is that both you and I, and indeed as I understand it everybody else who's been in the car so far, has only been allowed to drive it on the track, and so there's so much of that story we don't know the answer to, and you know that all by itself, as I've said on the Drive Nation post, is a reason that even if I felt it merited it, it could never get, you know, 10 out of 10, because, you know, there's half the story of that car remains untold. So I mean, I think, you know, there was always going to be an LT version. I'm so pleased that they have said how many they're going to build, so that hopefully, you know, and that it is now, well, what is it they say? They say it's sold out for this year and that they have more expressions of interest for next than they have build slots. So hopefully it will sell out. And hopefully, therefore, it will prove to be residually far more robust than the last LT, the 600LT. Whether you need it or not, I don't know. What I do know is I found driving it around Silverstone pretty mesmerizing. What about you?
Yeah, so I did the same thing as you. The international circuit, Silverstone, half the Grand Prix track in effect. And it was a good circuit actually to get to know that car, because it's quite wide with lots of really fast corners that you have to commit to, and that you need a huge amount of confidence in the car to drive through quickly. It did that stuff sensationally well. What I really liked about it is that you could put it into a quick corner like Stowe. So you're coming down the hangar straight, almost nudging 180 miles an hour in a road car, which is bonkers, and then hit the brakes.
Given, particularly on the international circuit, you don't come onto the hangar straight that fast.
Yeah. No, you crawl onto it, don't you?
Yeah.
Amazing, really. And you hit the brakes, and inevitably, if you're me, hit the brakes too early every single time. and then you're carrying a huge amount of speed through Stowe, the right-hander. But it's wonderful just feeling the front axle just begin to scrub across the road in understeer, and you feel it bleed into that, rather than it just happening all of a sudden. You're intuitively aware of when it's about to start doing that, which just means you put it on the limit of grip, corner after corner, with huge confidence. It sounds more sort of alive and thrilling than the 720S, as you'd expect. It was slightly damp when I first drove it, and we were on just P0s, or courses probably. But even on them, the grip was stunning. And then they put it on the Trofeo R when the track had dried a little bit. And the amount of grip that it's got, turning grip and mid-corner grip, it's staggering. And the body is so flat, it's such a stable platform, so you're never fighting its mass, you're never waiting for it to settle before you can commit to a corner, you just do it. It's sensationally fast. I mean, it's 765 horsepower. It's up to 80 kilos lighter than a 720, which is already a very light car.
It's only 30 kilos heavier than a Senna, and only 35 horsepower less powerful than a Senna. But it's a third of the price.
And it doesn't have anything like that, the Senna's drag. And so the way it... You hook fourth gear, which is when the systems give you everything, but that's the way it feels. And my God, it's lighting a rocket, isn't it? It's that sensation of just off you go.
Even to, you know, jaded, cynical hacks who have been lucky enough to drive a lot of really fast cars, you get in that. And even in the wide open space of Silverstone, which always slows things down, you're sitting there thinking, oh, okay, yep, okay, well, this is different. And it is, yeah, it is a sensationally rapid car. And I love the fact that they've dropped the final drive ratio. So, you know, you're just banging through gear after gear after gear, and it has that genuinely sort of relentless feel to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's stunning. So it's up, 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 isn't it? And it really pins you into the seat. And those seats, the carbon fiber seats, with a harness in particular on track, they're brilliant. They really clamp you in, and you don't ever think about rolling around in the seat. You just feel located, which makes a huge amount of difference.
Is there a butt heading its way to the author's conversation?
Why would you think that? I have no idea. A bit of a butt, yeah, there is. So I drove the car last week for Piston Heads, and we shot a video. And you'll, you know, if anyone wants to go and watch that video, please do, and you'll see I had a moment in it. My conclusion, you might feel differently, is that the car actually does have teeth. It's got some bite, particularly when you stick it into ESC dynamic mode. I'm told, and they only told me afterwards, which is perhaps half the problem, that in ESC dynamic mode, it actually allows you a huge amount of freedom. You can do
huge
big
amount, yeah,
smoky oversteer shots, you know, in that mode. And I think I was expecting it to effectively be like a BMW M dynamic mode, which just... that mode in the BMW is such a safety net. You can give it full clog, and the car will slide a little bit, but it'll always catch it every time. And so I was just expecting to be able to behave like a bit of a hooligan and just give it some welly and let the systems do the work. But actually, they did nothing whatsoever. They might as well have been off entirely. So it's coming onto the hanger straight out of the slow corner. And it just snaps.
That's tricky, isn't it? Because you've got that undulation, so the car sort of goes like as you're turning and you're getting back on the power. I know exactly what you mean.
And the rear end went, and I was twirling away at the wheel, doing everything I could. And I was just thinking, it's all right. I mean, dynamic mode, the systems will cut in any second. They haven't. It was a bit of a fright. I had Paul O'Neill in the car. He was the instructor, and he's the British touring car pundit. He's a touring car race winner, isn't it? And he's also won British GT. He's a great lad and clearly a very capable driver. And the moment it happened, we both just, and you know, nothing severe came of it. We both just wet ourselves laughing. It was it was so out of the blue, so unexpected. And it's, you know, I think an 800 horsepower rear drive twin turbo supercar, perhaps it's inevitable that it's got teeth.
I don't think it is inevitable.
That's exactly what I was going to say, because the Pista actually is a pussycat when you really start flinging it around. But the one that I remember most is the P1. I remember driving it at Anglesey. So it's probably a heavier car actually, isn't it? 1400 kilos or something, but it's a more powerful car. And partly because it had that torque fill from the electric motor, it was much more progressive when it started to break away under power. And I just remember skidding it around like it was nothing.
It's interesting, isn't it? I don't recall that from P1s at all. I can remember that with the LaFerrari. I was always quite intimidated by, listen to us talking about this, it's ridiculous, isn't it? But you know, but I can remember being quite intimidated by the P1 and not actually being that comfortable.
Really?
Hoofing it around. But you know, everybody's experience is different. There's so much of this is you know, down to individual conditions, you know, tire condition, whether you got your head screwed on the right way that particular morning or not. I completely understand what you say, and I think the car can be justly criticized for that trait, which I never had a moment when I was thinking, ooh, okay, this might be getting away. I didn't have that, but I was certainly busy at times. I mean, properly busy, and actually more at that particular corner that you had your moment at than any other. And I think it is right at least to have the conversation about whether a car like that actually needs a limited slip differential in it or some description, because as I'm sure lots of people listening to this know, you know, all McLarens, you know, come with open differentials, and they're quite cleverly controlled electronically. But, you know, whereas in something like a Pista or frankly any other comparable car, you can rely on the diff to help you establish the drift and keep your footing and keep it stable, and you don't have that in the McLaren, and it is it does definitely keep you on your toes. And what you find is you find yourself driving the way the car wants to be driven, not necessarily the way that you want to drive it. Now for me, I didn't find that particularly problematic, because I found driving it the way it wanted to be driven so exhilarating, so much fun. You know, not necessarily for sort of yee-haw, look at me, I'm going sideways reasons, but perhaps slightly more cerebral reasons. But nonetheless, no less fun for that. I thought the car was absolutely epic, and in the conditions I drove it in, which were absolutely dry and quite warm, I thought its breakaway characteristics were certainly quite feisty, but not, you know, malicious or problematic per se. But, you know, I let's put it this way. I completely understand why, you know, you feel the way that you do. I don't quite feel that way myself. But, you know, my perspective and my experience were slightly different. But it's certainly a question mark.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Yeah, so yeah, I mean, I did have a moment in it. Sadly, these things never look quite as epic on camera as they feel in the moment. So yeah, it won't look like a huge, terrifying incident, but it sort of felt that way in the moment. But that aside, yeah, I mean, the basic formula is so right, isn't it? It's actually quite significantly lighter than a 720 with more power and a more focused chassis and aero setup, and drive it on a quick circuit like Silverstone. And it's spellbinding. It really is.
Yeah.
Properly.
It's what I found a bit frustrating is, you know, what you say about the lightness is so right. When you drive that car, I just think to myself, I'm driving a light car, and I love that feeling. It's what I was saying about the SF90. You know, when you drive the SF90, however clever it is, you know you're driving a heavy car. And I you know, I wouldn't be surprised, and I'm not kidding, if the curb weight of a 765 LT and a standard SF90 weren't, you know, quite close to half a ton apart. And, you know, what I would love to have done is just taken it. There's a great little road route around Silverstone that I've been using for years, and I would just love to have just whacked it around that. I did that. I can remember when we drove the 675 LT, which was also done at Silverstone and also on track only. And I did sort of beg and plead and say, could I just take it out for a quick run around the road? And they went, oh, yeah, all right then. And I did. And to me, that just changed everything. I suddenly thought, wow, you know, this is, you know, I thought it was just a really good track car. I'm thinking, well, the problem's going to be you get it on the road and it's going to be, you know, uncomfortable and difficult and, you know, and it wasn't at all. And I don't know whether the 765 LT is going to be cut from that cloth or not, and I won't know it until I drive it on the road. Now, maybe, you know, McLaren's PR people are being very clever and they're thinking to themselves, well, here's two bites of the cherry. We'll let them drive it on the track and we'll get a load of coverage for that, and then we'll let them drive it on the road and we'll get another big chunk out of that. And, you know, I guess that as a strategy is entirely defensible. But I'd just love to know what it's like on the public road, because that's where most of them will spend most of their time, and we don't know the answer to that question yet.
Yeah, okay, so there we go. We'll have to come back to the McLaren 765 LT when one of us has driven it on the road. One last comment. I wish that they'd built five fewer of them, because they're building 765, and I wish they gave it 5 horsepower less and called it the 760 LT, because 765 LT and 675 LT, they're just too similar. My mind is not quite broad enough to be able to sort of separate the two of them. It just seems a bit too close.
Yeah.
Anyway, minor concern. Okay, well, let's leave that one there. Varied, that one, I think. electric cars and LT McLarens, but there we go, that's the way we like it. And remember, everybody, please do rate the podcast and leave a glowing review wherever you get your podcast. That basically, a podcast with lots of good reviews and ratings gets, gets dragged to the top by the podcast platform, and more people find the podcast, then it really, really helps. So please do that. Check us out on Instagram at DriveNation_. Have a look at us on Patreon, patreon.com/DriveNation, and bung us a couple of quid a month.
Or more.
Well, okay, yeah. Although we'd be very grateful for whatever you decide to
We'd be
pledge.
Very grateful for a couple of quid a month. I just wouldn't want anyone thinking that there yes. was somehow some kind of limit. On the amount of money that they can spend on us. Whatever you think we're worth would be greatly, greatly appreciated.
Absolutely. Yeah, and thank you everyone for listening, and we will be back with you again next week.
Look forward to it.
Goodbye.
The Drive Nation Podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.